Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Hope your new year is off to a great start. I'm back from Chattanooga and still digesting ribs from sticky fingers. Thank you, Hamilton County Conservatives, for hosting me. Third show this week, focusing on our nation today with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest Ryan Abraham. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. Welcome to our People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Ryan Abraham. Let me see here. I have this memorized, but owner and publisher of USCFootball.com, Heisman voter, host of the Peristyle podcast, an internet radio show covering the USC Trojan football team. Every week, host Ryan Abraham brings you multiple Trojan podcasts with a variety of guests and opinions talking about football, basketball, recruiting, and more. Co-hosts the podcast of Champions with where he discusses Pac-12 football on a weekly basis. Hosts Ryan Abraham and David Woods discuss the conference champions on the football field, breaking down games, picking against the spread, and keeping things interesting during the offseason. Hello, Ryan Abraham fans. How are you recovering from New Year's Eve and trip to Texas to the Cotton Bowl?
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it was fun down there in Dallas, Arlington, to go check out the Cotton Bowl. I've been there three times. USC hasn't won one of those games, and this one was a lot closer than the other two. But yeah, it was still fun. It was just a lot of travel stuff for the holidays. Luckily, my flights weren't. I wasn't delayed. My luggage isn't stuck in, Idaho or somewhere like a lot of other people that were traveling during the holiday. So I was lucky in that respect. But
must not fly Southwest. Out. That's good. Okay, but not a fun ride home. No.
I'm sure not. Yeah.
Did you know over the last five seasons, one out of 1,162 FBS teams were winning by 15 plus points in the final 5 minutes, and now it's two out of 1,692 with Tulane. I think we broke Vegas.
Yeah, it's a disappointing one. And to have two of those in one season, because the game in Salt Lake City in the middle of October, twice you weren't losing the entire game. And then within the final minute, USC gets the ball back with like 30 seconds against Utah. And then 9 seconds against Tulane. So it's two pretty heartbreaking losses where you were, the entire time you're expected to win the game, and then at the very end it all shifted. So yeah, that's a tough one. It was pretty emotional in the locker room afterwards. The guys that we got to talk to, Lincoln Riley, people were pretty upset about that one. I think one thing, Steve, that people were questioning the motivation of USC going into the game. And sometimes people don't care, they opt out of the bowls, they don't. This was not the case. Everyone played that could play. Maybe outside of Jordan Addison, and they cared about this game, but it just it didn't come together at the end.
Yeah, and for those that care, 2020 was the last time Texas versus Texas Tech, and that was an overtime win. So we are now in the record books as the second one. But a great season, came down to the last 4 minutes and kind of ruined it. But they can't take away that Heisman. Well, as with Reggie Bush, they can, but Caleb had a great season, but the injury really took its toll. Who is his backup?
Miller Moss. So he's a local product, like a redshirt freshman, and he's looked good. But I mean, Caleb Williams is, as long as I've been watching USC football, I haven't seen a better quarterback wearing cardinal and gold. And he gutted through the Pac-12 championship game, looked a lot healthier in this one. But to not have your best receiver and you still throw for 462 yards and five touchdowns, and you had a couple drops, you could have easily been over 500 yards. Yeah, he's pretty special, and he can get out, get away from the pass rush, run to his left, and still stop on a dime and deliver the ball. And he just does a lot of stuff that other quarterbacks just can't do. So I trust the NFL people that tell me he would have been the first pick in the NFL draft if he wasn't a sophomore, but he is. So he has to come back by law, you know, for one more year.
Well, unfortunately, 0-11 in bowl games since Sam Darnold, I believe, beat Penn State. Is that about right? 0-11?
0-11 is Pac-12 teams that lost the Pac-12 championship game. Maybe that's
I guess you're right.
So that's if you lose the championship game. But yes, USC hasn't won a bowl game. They haven't played 11, but they haven't won one since then. And you know that's and Lincoln Riley doesn't have a great bowl record either. But a lot of those were first round playoff games against like the LSU team that scored 63 on them, or Georgia, or things like that. But yeah, I think you mentioned the Heisman. I mean, they were 4-8 last year, and there's a lot of USC fans that are upset, but this is incredible improvement over that to win 11 games and to be, most importantly, I think, Steve, from nationally irrelevant and not a player on the main stage. They weren't someone that didn't matter. If you watch College Game Day, you didn't need to mention USC because they weren't any good. They weren't doing anything. Now you have to, because they were, one play away from making the college football playoff, winning the Heisman Trophy, having several All-Americans. So I think they're a more nationally relevant team again, which is something that USC hasn't been for a long time. So I get it. It's year one, but the expectations just got raised so high because it was Lincoln Riley and you had Caleb Williams and all that stuff. But it's still a lot, it was a disappointing loss, two of them this season. Yeah. But man, just to be able to be nationally relevant again is what's important, I think.
Yeah, and to lose to Utah twice. But so I back to you. I graduated in 93, and it feels like I've listened to you since then, but that's 30 years. When did you start?
I graduated in 93 also from USC. So undergrad, and I got my master's in 95. But like a year after that, in 1996, I started USCfootball.com like just as a hobby. And I don't think I had the domain name until 97, but I started a website and didn't really know much about buying domain names back then. And people are like, oh, how'd you buy that? I'm like, well, it was just open. Like there was just, you can go to, like, if you go to GoDaddy right now and like find something that's, PQXYZ.com, like USCfootball.com was open. So I bought it then, and it just kind of grew. And in 2001, I ended up joining my first network, which was Rivals.com. And in 2004, I ended up quitting my electrical engineering job and started doing this full time. So it's been like 18 years, I guess, since I started doing this. It's pretty crazy. Yeah, but it's been a lot of fun. It's been
well, you picked the right team because they're in the news every day. I mean, even in the off season, absolutely. How did you know it would be a career from a hobby?
No, I certainly didn't. It was fun to just, I loved writing about the team, and I'm an East Coast guy that moved to LA just for college. I'd never been on the West Coast before going to USC. And I used to create a newsletter at USC that I would snail mail back to my friends back East and try to get more mail and stuff just to have a connection. And I called it the USC Connection. And it sort of was like, maybe the beginning of it, where I would do writing and just kind of be funny about what's going on with the football team or what was going on with me in school. And, a friend that in my engineering world, before people had computers on their, at home, we were using them all the time at work. And so that's where I kind of learned how to, at the beginning, I wrote all the code myself. So I created the web, like literally created the website. Wow. And, but that was like the engineering background stuff. And, but it just, I never thought it would grow and then become like the side business. And then all of a sudden it was like, okay, well, it got big enough where I could do it as a full-time thing. So that's what I do now.
Awesome. Well, you not only do the Peristyle podcast, and for those that don't know, the Peristyle is the lattice work above the Coliseum, which I actually don't know if it's still there under the remodel or not. Is that, that's right. That's why you named it that?
Yeah. It's like for the Roman, whatever, like the Olympic torch is at the one end of the Coliseum, and the Peristyle of those arches. And we just kind of, that's where we kind of got the name from that. So it's been there like that way for a while.
Yeah, very cool. And so those that know, and now everyone else knows. But you also do the podcast of champions for all the Pac-12. Tell us a bit about that one and where do you find the time, man? I mean, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, that's more of a, like a labor of love. My partner, David Woods, covers UCLA. So you have like a, a USC guy and a UCLA guy on the same podcast, and it's just worked. We have good chemistry, and you know when you're broadcasting, people want to be informed, but you also have to be entertained. And you know, the off seasons, we have a lot of fun. We end up answering all kinds of questions about like which Pac-12 coach would win in a fight and things like that. There's a lot of that kind of stuff. A lot of Star Wars talk, Disney princess talk. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that we do in the off season, but it's a lot of fun. And then, it's good for me just to, cover the rest of the conference. Now, I don't know what we're going to do after USC and UCLA both leave, but we got to figure that out. But the just knowing like, hey, I followed like Oregon State a lot closer than I would have if I was just covering USC. So when the Trojans go up to Corvallis, like I could talk about like, yeah, I've watched a bunch of their games. So it was actually helped me do my USC job a little bit more, but it was fun. It's been fun the last, I think, 6 years we've been doing it, just to kind of get a better feel on the Pac-12 conference.
Yeah. Very cool. I enjoy it quite a bit because it is, you can't just only like the Pac. I used to call them the Pac-9, but the Pac-11. SC, standing alone and always talked about independence, but now they're deciding to join the Big Ten. I got a lot of questions about that, but I do want to start off with, oh, and by the way, for those who probably don't know, that intro that I did with the hello, that's the way Brian starts his show every day. But we are now in the era of the transfer portal. Heisman winner Caleb Williams came through the portal, so I'm not complaining, but how do you feel about like 700 plus kids, maybe more now since the season's actually over, in there? It does have the potential, like free agency, to kind of ruin the game, or at least the traditional teams like ours. But I hope not, because we both love college football and rooting for the team, even though we love when our team gets a superstar. If Reggie Bush had chosen Notre Dame over SC, it would be a whole different world for us. How do you feel about the portal era, I call it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not perfect, but I think it was necessary. I mean, you see a guy like Bobby Petrino, who's had a rough, go at it, NFL problems off the field in college. UNLV hires him less than a month ago, and then now he leaves those kids that he just met and goes to Texas A&M with Jimbo Fisher. Coaches have been able to do this all the time. And the fact
we had that with Cliff Kingsbury did the same thing.
He was there less than a month. I think you want to give the players the power to do it. I kind of like the one free transfer rule. I think if guys want to transfer more than once, they'll probably get waivers anyway. But there's, and you want to try to protect players too, because there's plenty of guys that are in that portal. You mentioned, I mean, there's over 1,000, I think, now. And they're going to make mistakes. There's guys that are going to leave probably the best opportunity they would have to play or to keep going in their college education, and think the grass is greener and end up not getting picked up by anybody and losing out. But that's sort of life too. I think just having the freedom to be able to move around. And then I think it can help, if you're it's not just like, hey, Alabama and Georgia are going to sign all these guys. They're going to get guys, but you're also, there's going to be guys that are like that five-star in their roster that isn't playing. He ends up going a level down. And I think there's going to be a lot of movement, and it can help all kinds of programs, not just the bigger programs. And, a place like USC, that you were pretty down in the dumps after going 4-8 and the roster wasn't in a good shape, Lincoln Riley can turn that around in 1 year. We saw Kalen DeBoer do the same sort of thing at Washington, bringing in Michael Penix and
Taj Washington from Memphis. He too was a big factor in from the portal. Yep.
And four of the top five tacklers for USC on this defense came out of the transfer portal. So most of their production on the defensive side, even though they didn't perform very well on defense, and guys like Caleb Williams, and they still had contributions from like a really veteran offensive line that was mostly around there. But their two running backs, Travis Dye and Austin Jones, both came from Pac-12 teams in transfer portal. And so I think it's sort of I don't know if it's necessarily evil, but I think you need to have the ability for players to want to leave. I think they just want to have the support there to make sure that there's going to be some bad decisions made because you have that freedom. Is there going to be kind of a soft landing for some of those guys if they make the wrong decision? But I don't think you can take away the fact that if someone wants to leave, if you went to a school for this coach and the day after you get there, he leaves, you have no recourse. At least the players have some recourse now. And I think that's probably the most important aspect.
I wanted to get your take on this quote from Kirby Smart, who obviously has a pretty good team over there, Georgia Bulldogs. And he actually graduated from Georgia. He said, this would be the first time Georgia has not taken a quarterback under Kirby. I'm sorry. This has to do with this. This would be the first time Georgia has not taken a quarterback under Kirby Smart, but he thinks the day and age of quarterback recruiting has changed. He said, I think it's irrelevant in today's day and age. The portal is full of them. Smart said, there's going to be multiple guys in every year. You want to do the best job you can to get the best quarterback you can. What's he telling us that quarterbacks are going to be traded like trading cards versus, say, a guy who can come all the way up the ranks or would choose to come back for a second year like Matt Leinart did or now Caleb did? Well, he has to, but.
Yeah, I mean it's the most unique and important position we have, I think, in American sports, where there's only one ball. I mean, if you have a great running back, you can have two, and they can both play. It's just really not the case when you have a quarterback. So I think when you talk about the transfer portal, that's going to be the featured position. That's the position that you're going to look at the most. And a guy like Joe Burrow had maybe the best college football season we've seen from a quarterback ever. And he wasn't getting on the field at Ohio State because of Justin Fields. So he ends up going to LSU and just crushing it, And so it's an opportunity. And Lincoln Riley had made a living off bringing in transfer port quarterbacks. And you got a guy like Baker Mayfield, who was a walk-on at one point, ends up transferring and winning the Heisman Trophy. Kyler Murray going from A&M, and so USC saw Caleb Williams come from Oklahoma to USC and win the Heisman right away. Now, he was recruited out of high school by Lincoln Riley. So if Lincoln Riley stayed at Oklahoma, he probably would have won the Heisman at Oklahoma, I would assume. So that would have been his first kind of like homegrown, but I'll still count that as kind of a homegrown quarterback for Lincoln Riley. So I think there's a
Well,
mix. And
Lincoln
the
Riley
problem
has
is you.
had six of the last six winners or runner-ups in the Heisman. I mean, the guy, and he's only been a coach for 6 years. I mean, it's unbelievable. Is that
That's
right? Do I have that
crazy.
right? Yeah. And then, of
So.
course, the downside of what you're talking about is former Trojan JT Daniels is on his fifth school. That
Yeah, you got
hurts.
Keaton Slovis, JT Daniels, they have left. And, it's an opportunity to try to find a soft landing somewhere else where you can go and play. And, a guy like Miller Moss has stuck around and he might leave. It's one of those things where we used to see, like Kirby Smart, they're recruiting at such a high level. You would get sort of like a five-star quarterback, and like maybe the odd years. And then you get like maybe a high three-star, low four-star quarterback in the even years, and then get another five to get like back-to-back five stars was tough. Now it's even harder to do that because that middle four-star guy or three-star guy, he's going to leave. That was Keaton Slovis for USC ends up like being the starter. And once you've realized you're the guy, you were the guy and you're not going to be the guy anymore, you're out. Like if it's Spencer Rattler, like would he have been better off just sticking around at Oklahoma? No, he leaves. He had some success at South Carolina, but, and sometimes they make, that's the most glaring mistakes are probably going to be like from the quarterback spot. You see guys leave and people get hurt all the time. You're like, wow, if that guy was still around, he would have been like the starter for this nationally relevant team. But now he's like in obscurity somewhere else. Or you're JT Daniels. And, he was this close to being the starting quarterback of a national championship contender. And then, now you're moving, now you're Rice, So there's a lot in that, for the quarterbacks when they're moving and things like that. But, I feel like it's one of those things. It's going to change recruiting because if you don't get that high school guy you want, or the high school guy you love that you recruited last year isn't sticking around because you have such a good guy that's starting, now you could just go get somebody else's, quarterback. And it's not always, there's always reasons to leave, right? Like there's reasons for breakups for both sides. A lot of guys in the portal are in there for a reason. It's not necessarily because they were a great teammate or whatever, but a lot of guys are just the Joe Burrows of the world where like, hey, I'm good. I can play. I know they got an established guy. Give me a chance somewhere else. Oh, and I'll go win the Heisman. So it's
Yeah, and in
definitely changed.
college,
I
you
think
don't
Kirby's
have the
right.
time like a Joe Montana with a Steve Young as a backup, where you can do a dynasty. You got 2 to 3 years and that's it. So you got to go. So you really have to decide if you're a great backup quarterback, you might as well be a great starting quarterback for somebody else if given the opportunity. Nick Saban said, he was talking about Young and Anderson. I think these guys sent a message to everybody that you create value for yourself by playing football. You don't create value for yourself by opting out and getting ready for the draft. What are you getting ready for? The combine? Half the stuff you do at the combine isn't relative to football, But when you play against good competition and you play well, that creates value. And I think it speaks volumes of your character when you choose to be a part of your team and you can be counted on to be a part of your team regardless of the circumstances, and you finish the season with your team. These two guys will be top five picks, yet you see guys who might be third, fourth rounders opting out. You mentioned it, that our game, everyone played. What do you think of that? I mean, I get the point, right? If you injure yourself, you could lose millions of dollars in that playoff game, which is going to be a tough fight usually. But how do you feel about that in general?
Yeah, I think, Saban is pretty lucky to have that situation where you have two guys that are going to be extremely high draft picks and they both opt to play in for a non-playoff game. And that's probably going to be more the exception than the rule, but I would give I'd give Nick Saban and Lincoln Riley credit. The culture that you kind of create around the team, we're in this NIL world and everything where like it's
I want to
get
to that,
getting more money or whatever, but part of it is still like the college game and wanting to be with your teammates. Like Caleb Williams could have opted out of this bowl game, you know, the Cotton Bowl. You're playing Tulane and he already won the Heisman. You know, everyone knows who he is, but he wanted to play. He wanted to be out there with his teammates. And I think Bryce Young saying the same kind of stuff. So I would give credit to those coaches that create the culture around. It's not like we want you to go out and take extra risks, but you know, you're part of this team. And if you want to play and be a part of it, and you want to leave your teammates hanging, they create that good culture and give these guys opportunities to do that. If you only went to a school, like we saw the Texas A&M recruiting class with all the money that was being handed out and all that stuff, if you're only going there because you're going to get paid, you're like, yeah, I don't really need to play. That's probably not the right culture to get a bunch of guys to opt into a bowl game like that. So I give them credit. And I think you're going to see more of that with like good cultures where it's more about the team and everything, as opposed to someone that's just going out and having some booster group just drop a whole bunch of money on recruits' doorsteps so they can come to their school. You're probably not going to have that same kind of chemistry where you're going to want to play in a situation that could potentially, you know, hurt your NFL draft stock or, you know, whatever.
Yeah. On a side note, I did find it fascinating that the first Texas team to make it to the championship game was TCU and not A&M or Texas. But our former SC coach and current Ole Miss coach Lane Kiffin says he's got to make sure players on his roster aren't getting bought by other players. Tampering is a real thing. With the money now involved, is poaching going to be a problem?
Yeah, it's funny. And it's interesting that he would say that. And I think Jimbo Fisher came out and said something along those lines where he was, you know, they were one of the bigger culprits. And the problem is that this whole NIL space was fought tooth and nail by the NCAA. So they didn't want this at all. And eventually it was going to happen and they weren't ready. And they basically wrote like three lines of guidelines, like here's what NIL is, and people can interpret that in very different ways. And you're not supposed to provide inducements for players to pick your school, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense because just, I mean, like, oh, you have like eight Heismans. Is that an inducement? Because you're like, it's a very attractive program, or you're in Los Angeles, or you've got put a lot of guys in the NFL. But the point was, you shouldn't be like saying, hey, if you come to our school, we'll give you X amount of $1 million or whatever. And that's out there happening at certain schools, not everywhere. And I feel like that's part of, some of the problem of what's going on in this, you know, NIL world. You know,
and for those that don't know, that means name, image, and likeness, NIL. So besides the era of the portal, we are fully into now the era of the NIL. I'm looking at the 2002 roster for SC and I was stunned. I don't really even understand it. Not a lot of sports media discussing it that I've heard. Caleb Williams, $3.2 million. Addison, $1.2 million, who decided not to play in the bowl game, in the Cotton Bowl. Do I have that right? Do they get a check that large from SC?
No, don't have that right.
Thank you. Please clarify for me.
That's part of the problem too. And, USC isn't paying players. Universities are not paying players. And they're not allowed to do that. But they can, if you're in LA and you're Caleb Williams, you can get deals. You can have an agent. There's no official list anywhere. That some people try to put stuff out there, estimates of what they think guys are making, but no one's ever announced that Caleb Williams has this kind of deal. When Jordan Addison first left Pitt and came to USC, someone tweeted out, like, he's getting this $3 million deal from USC. And then everyone just kind of ran with it. And that's not the case at all. But that's sort of the perception that was out there. The ironic thing is a lot of people think USC is part of this, NIL stuff. Internally, they don't really have their ducks in a row. When something changes in the landscape of college football, USC is not usually at the forefront of going out and jumping ahead of it. Even the early signing period when it first came out, USC didn't really get into that until the next year. They were still trying to sign guys in February, where most every other college football power realized December was going to be the default signing period. USC is also kind of behind in the whole NIL space. They don't have like a functioning collective that's getting a bunch of booster money and providing it for players and things. So you can get good money, and Caleb Williams is probably making in the millions because he's a superstar in Los Angeles, but you're like the starting center. You're probably not getting the same kind of deals if you were the starting center at like Tennessee, where they have a huge collective in place and they're like making sure guys get paid and all that. So there's no like official list of like these guys are making this much money. The schools are not supposed to be.
So I'm looking at this website here that is a USC Trojan website, and it has everybody listed, everything from Corey Foreman at 220,000.
USC site though. Yeah, whose site is it?
It says USC-Trojan/football/2022/roster. So I can't endorse it or anything, but it's where I did my homework on this podcast. Oh, yeah. It just has a bunch of money. And so when I saw the money that a quarterback like Caleb Williams would get, and 2 years ago would have gotten zero, I was like, wow. But let me read what Jimbo Fisher had to say.
Oh, sure.
I knew eventually there would be a pay for play, but I did not know it would be NIL like it came about. The problem with all of it is that there is no consistency and rules. And then when you get into the transfer portal, there is so much tampering going on. It is utterly ridiculous. It is a joke. It's an absolute joke. We are only in college football. Jimbo Fisher on tampering, NIL, and the transfer portal. I know Tennessee has a $9 million fund because I interviewed your counterpart for the Vols on the show. And you said SC doesn't have a strategy. They do. At least it seems to be. I just worry the whole thing's going to lead to like unionization and even just, healthcare costing schools a fortune. Do I just have the whole concept wrong?
No. I think that's a legit concern, because the more this happens, then the players become employees, and then there's collective bargaining.
Exactly.
There's the all that kind of stuff comes into play. And, if you're an employee, you can get fired, and it's going to certainly change. It's already changed the college football landscape and how we do things in this sport, but you're going down this road where it's going to be collectively bargained, and the schools will be paying players directly instead of some kind of booster group. Like a school like USC doesn't want, they've been in trouble by the NCAA before. And like, technically, if you had a booster group paying a high school player to come to your school, like, that's like technically against the rules, but there's not really like a rule that, or like something, we don't know what the consequences would be. So places like Texas A&M and Tennessee are doing that.
Well, Tennessee had the McDonald's bags of money, if you remember that news story. So
yeah,
that, and I guess they don't have to do that anymore. Now they could just write them a check.
It's all above board. So if you were giving a McDonald's bag before, now you can like just put, it's like a GoFundMe. You put it together and like, hey, let's go buy some prospects. So USC has been kind of reluctant to do that. But there's other ways that you would attract players to USC, but the Jimbo Fisher quote is very funny, because they signed the best recruit. Like, we track all the recruiting classes at 24/7 Sports, and they have the best historical class ever. And this was after they were pretty terrible, So, well, what's the difference here? Well, they had this enormous collective with all this oil money, and they were to put together packages for all these prospects. Like, hey, you come here, you can get this much money. And they were very ahead of the curve, and that's why they had the number one recruiting class in the history of college football. But a lot of those guys are leaving now because the team was terrible. And is it are you guaranteed to be you get money and then you're like, yeah, this sucks, I'm going to leave? And they can still leave and somewhere else. But I think the tampering is still a problem, like Lincoln Riley said. I mean, Lane Kiffin said, and Jimbo Fisher said. They need some better rules in place, and the NCAA was kind of waiting for Congress to bail them out and fix some of the stuff. I don't think that's going to happen, but tampering is real, and if you're a player, like if we're both, you know, if we played high school football together and then you're at, you know, UCLA and I'm at Texas and, you know, and UCLA is terrible. And I call you like, hey, we played together. Come play with me. Like, is that tampering? Like we were high school teammates, you know, I think stuff like that's going on. But if you have, you know, a booster group calling a kid that's very happy at the school he's at and going, if you leave, I'll give you $2 million. Like once you're in the portal, you're recruitable. Like that makes sense. Like you put your name in the portal. That means, hey, come recruit me. If you don't, that's where, you know, I think they could, if they could crack down on that, that would be great. But you could go through intermediaries and things like that. But I think that's what Jimbo's talking about, that guys aren't even in the portal. People like realize their situation is like, it's kind of questionable. Let's give them a call, put a bunch of money in front of them, see if they'll leave.
It seems crazy that even if you don't want to actually leave, you don't just throw your name in the portal and see if a phone call comes. Because if somebody's saying, hey, come to Tennessee, we'll give you $1.6 million. And then you're in the portal planning on earning that $1.6 million, but then you get a call and someone says, hey, we'll give you $2.5 million. Why? It's the difference between putting your name in the hat and not putting your name in the hat. So I don't know, but I want to talk more about SC and we're going to run out of time, unfortunately. The coach hiring at SC has always looked like they're trying to repeat the Pete Carroll magic. Carroll DNA was why they took a chance on Kiffin. That didn't work out. Sark, who's at Texas now, was at Alabama. Helton. We get jilted by Kingsbury, and now we have Riley, who did an amazing turnaround. You nailed it. That is exactly right. You can't take that away from them. What made the new AD Bone and President Carroll Folt finally go get a good one?
That's a great question, and that's something that USC has been sort of reluctant to do. And I think it always starts with leadership, like people at the top making decisions. They've had, you know, presidents that weren't, you know, Max Nikias was around, and there's a whole bunch of scandals under his watch. I think fundraising was the most important thing to him, and you end up hiring, you know, he ends up hiring a bunch of athletic directors that had no athletic director experience whatsoever. You bring in Pat Hayden.
And Heisman's dog. Yep. Swan Hayden and Garrett. Yeah.
They were former football players. Like that's why you bring them in. And so that's at the very top, you're making a bad decision and it sort of trickles down. And you have a bad athletic director who's never done that before. They make bad hires. They hire people they're familiar with instead of going out and just getting the best guy at the job. And you can even go back to Pete Carroll. And I think you mentioned Nick Saban. What makes him so great, the longevity there, is that if he loses Kirby Smart, you know, his defensive coordinator, and he goes on to Georgia and becomes a national championship winning head coach, he doesn't promote from within. He goes out and gets the next best defensive coordinator from somewhere else, someone that's already proven that he can do it. Pete Carroll was loving his own coaching tree. He tried to create, you know, the Ken Norton Juniors, who's, you know, he's had success as a coach. He was a GA under you. He'd never coached before. And Pete Carroll would try to take those guys and make them coaches. And two of those guys were Lane Kiffin and Steve Sarkisian. So he kind of elevated them. And then they become beloved because Pete Carroll wanted to create them as these beloved, you know, coaches. And USC ends up hiring as their head coaches later on. So sort of like these early on decisions that were sort, you know, you shouldn't have ever got rid of Norm Chow. You could have just got some more experienced guys, but Pete Carroll sort of elevated them, and then USC later on elevates them as again, and you have years and years of making bad coaching decisions. And then with Sark completely, you know, turning the program on its head with his off-the-field stuff, then you end up hiring just kind of a vanilla head coach only because he's been around the program for a while. Second time he's been the interim head coach because he's the adult in the room and he's not going to screw things up. But he's not a, you know, he's not a winner.
And then he hired his relatives and his buddies and whatever.
Yeah. So just years and years of bad decisions from the very top, you know, down to the coaching stuff, and the coaches make bad, you know, hires. Yeah. It's like a smart guy told me once that A's hire A's and B's hire C's because B's don't want to hire an A that would take their job. And that's exactly what's been happening at USC. You finally hired an A. So you got Lincoln Riley. And I think that's, it took, you know, new athletic director, new leadership at the president's spot to do something like that. And they finally did it. And what happens? 1 year, you turn the program around. So all it takes is like.
And you've been saying that for years. I've been listening to you say it. So you called it. They should have hired you a long time ago. You know, USC became known for outstanding tailbacks with Garrett Simpson, Clarence Davis, Anthony Davis, and Ricky Bell. They all flourished in the I formation back under McKay in the 60s. why don't we ever commit to the run? I mean, we had Reggie, and that's about it. I remember, you know, McKnight, tragic end for him. But the Lindell White, Reggie Bush thing, would it not work in this era? All these 100
No, I think. Games? Yeah, I think you could. I mean, you know, Lindell White's still the leading, you know, career touchdown leader for USC, 52, if I don't, you know, and he's still around. And I think you could do it. I think the one thing that you've liked about, you know, Lincoln Riley, it's a, you know, air raid type of offense from that Mike Leach, you know, rest in peace, Mike Leach, his tree. But he's always had, or I think 4 of the 5 years at Oklahoma, he's had 1,000-yard rushers. And you might see, like, you know, I think Travis Dye was having a huge year before he ended up getting injured. And Austin Jones had a couple of really nice games going down. And you saw Raelic Brown have a pretty big game in the Cotton Bowl. He might be the tailback of the future. So I feel like you could still have that. You know, it won't be I formation. They aren't going to be under center all the time. But you can have a featured back that's got, you know, 1,200, 1,300 yards in these kind of spread systems. Not everyone's the same. Like the Graham Harrell, you know, kind of spread that USC was running before, that's not really featuring tailbacks and do it. But, you know, Lincoln Riley, he does like to do that and likes the run game to be a bigger part of it. So I think Travis Dye would have been a 1,000-yard rusher if he stayed healthy for the season. But it's, you know, the passing game is just so important. That's the reason why Nick Saban went from, like, run first defensive team to, like, hey, man, we got to score. Because even the best defenses are giving up a crap load of points. Watch these bowl games. Like, Georgia's, like, their defense is great, all these NFL guys, and they give up a whole bunch of points. And Alabama gives up a whole bunch. You're giving up a
I think it was the most – they had to have the most defensive points. I mean, SC was good with turnovers, but the defenses gave up a lot all over the NCAA this year, and I want to ask you at the end about that. The future of the offensive line. Voorhees is going to the draft. Before this season, the offensive line was pretty bad, I think. Maybe you might agree, maybe you disagree, I don't know. But SC always sends kids to the draft, and we rebuild fast. Lots of talent want to come here. But this O-line was pretty special for Caleb. I guess under Helton, it was kind of, in my opinion, I just remember always talking about the O-line, especially against that bowl game against Ohio State, remember? And since we're going into the Big Ten, what do you think of our matchups? What do you think that will look like there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's they bring in Josh Henson, who did a really nice job at Texas A&M to coach the offensive line. And USC's offensive line last year, even though the team was bad, they were better. It was really the first year that they had a spread offense with Graham Harrell, the offensive coordinator. And instead of having like a power running offensive line coach like Tim Drevna, which they had for 2 years, they bring in Clay McGuire, who went on to Washington State after, you know, last year. And they were a lot better on some of the, you know, he was a spread offensive line coach matched with an offensive. That was just another bad decision. You had like an offensive line coach that had a different philosophy than an offensive coordinator. But I feel like, you know, this year they did bring back a lot of veterans. You see Andrew Voorhees, Brett Nealon, the center, you know, he was an All-American, and Justin Dietich was one of the team captains. And we'll see, he might potentially come back. But they didn't have a lot of depth. And so we saw some of the younger guys play later in the season because two of those linemen were out for the bowl game. And they've done a pretty good job on the recruiting trail. But that's going to be the key for this one. We saw Caleb Williams just get away from the rush a lot when he would get pressured. But you'd rather not have him do that if he doesn't have to. So I think rebuilding, you know, what was a veteran offensive line this year in 2023 is going to be a big task. And, you know, obviously on the defensive side, they got to do a lot of that stuff too. But I feel like on the offensive side, he can recruit well. They'll bring in skill guys. You know, obviously they bring in quarterbacks, and you can make things work on the offensive line. But I don't think you're going to be a national championship kind of contender without a great offensive line. So the talent wasn't great when they came in, but they had really good kind of starting group. So the big question for me will be how Lincoln Riley kind of builds on that going forward, because they do lose a lot of veteran leadership off that line this year.
Okay, the obvious question, defensive coordinator Grinch. We lived a long time with Helton's buddy. I forget his name all of a sudden. Will they give Clancy him Pendergast. More time? Yes, right. What was it?
Clancy Pendergast.
Yeah, I want everybody to hear that. Will they give him more time, Grinch, or is he out after poor tackling versus Utah? And, you know, I have a total defensive chart here in front of me. Air Force was number one, Iowa 2, Illinois 3, Minnesota 9, Michigan 6, Wisconsin 10, USC 106. We're going to need help against the Big Ten. I assume we'll be in the West Division. They got defense. What are we going to do?
No, it's a great question, because there, if you look at any of the advanced stats that are like, you know, points per game is one thing, but they, you know, games are different. There's more drives or less drives. Like points per drive is really important. You know, yards per play or some of the new stats. USC is in the hundreds of all of those. And you can't, you know, to be, you look at Lincoln Riley's defenses when he was at Oklahoma, they were like a top 40 defense. And you're like, oh, those were bad. Like, this defense was really, really bad. There was almost 2,000 yards the last four games they had given up. Just crazy numbers. And you can't do that and be a national championship contender. And you have one more year of Caleb Williams. He's a generational talent. You can't squander that. The problem is, if you remember when Lincoln Riley came last November, or it's two Novembers ago, you know, the middle of the night in that plane after Bedlam, like, Alex Grinch was one of the guys on that plane, you know, and so he's been with him for a while. I don't think you can keep going the way you're going, and it might be switching around the staff. It might be, you know, making Grinch do different stuff. It's hard to say. They're going to get more guys in the portal. They got to get better players. I think that's clear. But they had three All-Americans on the defensive side of the ball. They shouldn't have been this bad. I think the right move would be to fire Alex Grinch and try to bring someone in like a Jim Leonard, you know, from Wisconsin. But, you know, someone that's just a really good defensive coordinator, I'm not sure if he's going to do it. And but I know you can't do the same thing. You can't keep going with where status quo is not going to work. You can't just say it was players. So I'm curious to see what he does. But he was asked after the game, Lincoln Riley was, and he said, you know, it's right after the game. We're not taking a big picture look at the program right now. We're going to do a deep dive over the next few weeks. And if USC fans have their way, his deep dive is going to lean to getting a new defensive coordinator. I don't know if it's that simple, if that's really what he's going to do. It's, you know, my opinion is probably what you should do. Just, I like Alex Grinch. I think he's very forthcoming. Like, when, you know, you talk about Clay Helton, he would paint a rosy picture for everything. Grinch will tell you like it is, like, we sucked. We did this bad. We did this bad. I think that's refreshing. But at the end of the day, you got to like stop somebody, and they couldn't stop a pretty mediocre Tulane team. So in my opinion, you probably should make a move. We'll have to see what Lincoln Riley does, but I think we'll hear something probably by February, early February, the national signing day. I think that's the next time we'll hear from Lincoln Riley. Will it be that he's going to get a new defense coordinator? I don't know at this point.
All right. Well, we got about 4 more minutes left, and I have a page left of questions. I don't think we're going to get to them. That happens to be every show, but that's okay. Who do you predict the big rival will emerge to be? UCLA always, Notre Dame, of course, but without having to worry about Utah or Stanford anymore, who do you think? You know, Carroll and Harbaugh had some animosity for a while until Pete went to the Seahawks. Maybe Lincoln can reignite that against Michigan. Who do you think the Big Ten rival for USC is going to be?
That's a great question too, because you mentioned like the division. I don't know what they're going to do. They're probably going to get rid of the divisions or make some pods or something. It'd probably be a little bit different. The natural one, I think, would be Ohio State. You know, the two teams that have had the most success. I mean, Michigan could be there too. And USC's got a long history with those programs, a little bit of Penn State, but pretty much the blue bloods are what you're going to, like, I don't think it's going to be Purdue or anything like that. Yeah. But like, you know, Ohio State, it's just like, you know, it's like you have these two alphas that are coming together, and, you know, they're not normally in the same neighborhood, and now they are, and they're going to have like a street fight or something. So I would gravitate towards Ohio State just because of all the, you know, the Heisman, you know, you put, I think, 15 Heisman between the two programs. So I would probably go with Ohio State on that one.
Yeah, and a great place to see a game. Yeah. Reggie, Matt, Sanchez, they're announcing now. You're in media as well. Any thoughts on former Trojans on TV and their skills?
Yeah, I think Reggie and Matt are doing a nice job. I talked to Matt. He lives close by. I talk to him fairly regularly. You know, Reggie's blowing up. They make, you know, the Fox guys I talk to, they make fun of him because every time they turn around, he's on a different Wendy's commercial and stuff. So props for that. But like a guy like Mark Sanchez, I've covered him when he was 16 years old in high school. And to see him, you know, having a lot of success on Fox is great. And, you know, they've had, you know, guys like Pat Hayden and Lynn Swan for years. They've had like kind of a history of former USC guys sort of doing that. So yeah, it's good for them. And it's fun to see guys that I covered, like, you know, through their recruiting process. Now they're like, you know, these big time, announcers. And the fact that Sanchez is doing NFL stuff is pretty cool too.
In all your years, have you ever seen anything like what happened to Damar Hamlin on Monday night?
I tried to think of something, and no, I was in the airport flying back from Dallas from the Cotton Bowl and just was trying to watch Monday Night Football. I didn't even realize what had happened. I'm like, why aren't they playing yet? And you kind of realize, but yeah, we've seen, you know, bad injuries. We've seen ambulances come out in the field, guys on stretchers, but I've never seen anything like that where it just, everything sort of stops. And yeah, it just definitely makes you reflect on the game. And it doesn't seem like it was really a football thing. It was just, you know, I guess there, you know, you hear guys that are like, what happens in lacrosse? If you just get hit in the chest in the right spot, it can stop your heart or you can have this cardiac event. So yeah, it's just one of those, just, it seems like one in a billion shot. And, you know, hope the results, I mean, it seems like he's getting better, which is great. But yeah, I've never seen anything like that in football.
Neither have I. And just last question, probably could do a whole show on it, but just quick question. Did SC have a 100% vaccine policy like the Buffalo Bills did? And do you think that has anything to do with the high scoring kind of weaker defenses this year?
So I don't know about like the policies for like the vaccination stuff. The whole Pac-12 was way more conservative than others, and the Pac-12 was going to not even have a season. The testing and stuff, I think they were like over the top with some of that. Stanford couldn't even practice on their campus. They had to go up to Humboldt, like 400 miles away to practice. I think San Jose State was the same way. For USC, I think I don't know if there was a vaccine mandate, but there was definitely a lot of testing and a lot of where guys were doing like workouts on their own, or they just couldn't, you know, trying to practice. They had to go in small groups and stuff. I think the West Coast got hurt in general, just because there was a lot less football being played at the high school level as well. And so guys like Corey Foreman, who were five-star players, like they didn't play their senior year. And so there was a lot more of those guys that didn't get to play in high school. That was probably what I've noticed, probably the biggest factor of COVID kind of on the West Coast. We're seeing all these guys, it's like rosters are way bigger because everyone got a free COVID year. But some of the development, I think, on the West Coast, where things were more conservative as far as not letting guys play, I think that's probably what was the most impactful, at least what I saw.
Excellent point. Okay. Well, Ryan, thank you for your time. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. We are at the end here. Please tell our listeners where they can go and find out more about you, your websites, your podcasts, anything you wanted to tell them.
Well, thanks, Steve. Yeah, USCFootball.com. Like I said, we've been around since 1996, which is a little crazy, but you can follow me on Twitter. I'm on there probably too much, at Inside Troy. Wasn't sure if it was going to stick around, but it looks like it is. So we have a lot of fun on Twitter. It's a great time. But the Peristyle podcast is my USC podcast, and the podcast of champions is the Pac-12 one. So if you love or hate USC, maybe give a listen. And if you're a fan of any of the Pac-12 programs, the podcast of champions, something you should check out too.
And we'll have to get you a Big Ten one as well.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, that's, I don't know if there is one right now. So, but we've had a lot of fun. Covering the conference is kind of fun. It's just like a different perspective, you know? And so, yeah, I guess in 2024, I might have to switch to the Big Ten.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on with us. Happy New Year. Fight on.
Happy New Year, Steve. Thanks.
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what do you think of our guest, Ryan?
Well, I really enjoyed having Ryan on, and as I was saying off air, it's nice to have a break in between the politics and the world issues and have something light. And Steve, I didn't know you were such a football fan. You are a fanatic. I mean, that's what fan means. It's short for fanatic. You and Ryan are both fanatics, and he's been able to spin that fanaticism into having a couple, two or three shows, and he's making enough money to make it worth his while living there in Southern California. Kudos for that guy. Great guy, great guest. And we had fun off air talking a little bit about our history. But Ryan's been at it for 2008. So,
yeah, very early pioneer in the podcasting space. And, you know, he lives the adage, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life.
I'm working on that, Steve. I started in 2007 and I'm not there yet. So I started podcasting in 2000.
Matters. Yeah. That's why I hired you. Something that we don't love. I put together the top 9 times, I'm going to save some time here, Mitch McConnell worked against conservatives in 2022. Last 2 days, I was going after Biden pretty hard, but I just wanted to prove that it's not always the Democrats that make these absurd anti-American policies and rules and things that have gotten America to the place that it is now. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican, Kentucky, has worked against conservatives throughout his career. Here are 9 times he betrayed, opposed, and contradicted conservatives in 2022. Number 1, McConnell gave Ukraine $45 billion in aid. In December, McConnell worked with Democrats to pass the $1.7 trillion omnibus bill, which included $45 billion worth of American taxpayers' money designated for Ukraine. The $45 billion is in addition to the $66 billion of taxpayers' money American lawmakers had already approved for Ukraine. Quote, providing assistance for Ukrainians to defeat the Russians is the number one priority for the United States right now, according to most Republicans. That's sort of how we see the challenge confronting the country at the moment, McConnell claimed. Well, all the polling shows that Republicans do not consider that the number one thing. Number 2, McConnell pushed omnibus spending bill despite House Republican objection. In November, McConnell worked against House conservatives to push the whole $1.7 trillion omnibus bill through Congress. House Republicans objected to the omnibus bill because it provided funding for the whole fiscal year. As an alternative, House Republicans argued for a short-term spending bill so they could have more input about the new Republican House majority that took office in January. So basically, he hamstrung the entire new Congress for a whole legislative year. What do you think of that, Steve?
I think Mitch McConnell works for the syndicate. Quite frankly, he works for the syndicate. He's part of the good old boy system that really... you see it in every state, you see it in every county, you see it in every township. These guys love power, they love the money that comes with it, and they have a globalist agenda, especially Mitch McConnell. He has never voted for something that's constitutionalist, that's God-fearing, that is in our best interest. It's always in the interest of those who actually pad his wallet and tell him what to do.
Yeah, and his daughter happens to be, his wife happens to be the daughter of a Chinese shipping magnate who has a monopoly on a lot of things coming out of China and into the United States. So there's definitely a conflict there. I'm sure I'd love to see an audit of his bank account. Let's play clip one.
What you might do differently in terms of a political strategy heading into 2024, or what you might advise the NRSC to do differently heading into 2024?
Our problem in the... You're talking about the real election, November the 8th, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Here's the problem. We underperformed among voters who did not like President Biden's performance in among independents and among moderate Republicans who looked at us and concluded too much chaos, too much negativity. And we turned off a lot of these centrist voters, which is why I never predicted a red wave to begin with, if you all recall. I said all along this is going to be close. In the poll data we had in the states that we were trying to win, which is the ones we currently had, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin, Missouri, this was a problem in all of them. It wasn't fatal in but one of them. And that was Pennsylvania. Dr. Oz was trying to run as a moderate, trying to appeal to those voters in Bucks and Chester County surrounding Philadelphia. That message got muddled at the end, which made it very difficult for him to achieve success. We had the same problem in Nevada, which is our best pickup opportunity. It reflected itself in Georgia as well, but fortunately, I didn't used to like the runoff in Georgia. All of a sudden, I like it a lot better than I used to. We got a second chance in Georgia to get it right, but that was the problem. The base turned out. We had significant Republican base turnout. We have a problem with people in the middle who still, even though there's not as many of them as there used to be, determine the outcome.
Is that Trump's fault?
Yeah.
How
how do you assess the NRSC's performance under Rick Scott, and will there be changes under Chairman Dane?
Yeah, that's up to Steve. I don't intend to assess the performance at all. I think, Steve, I don't know if you want to address anything about your plan.
So that's his postmortem on why the red wave didn't happen. How about this? Number three, McConnell pulled PAC ads out of New Hampshire, effectively sabotaging GOP candidate Don Bolduc. In October, the McConnell-backed Senate Leadership Fund pulled all its ads off television in New Hampshire. The decision ripped $5.6 million away from Republican General Don Bolduc's candidacy and greatly helped incumbent Democrat Senator Maggie Hassan, Democrat New Hampshire, win re-election. Four, McConnell attacked Senate Republican candidate Kelly Chewbacca. The McConnell-backed Senate Republican Leadership Fund focused $9 million against conservative Senate candidate Kelly Chewbacca to protect 21-year incumbent and pro-impeachment Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican Alaska. The money helped Murkowski defeat Chewbacca in November. In October, the Alaska Republican Party censored McConnell for attacking fellow Republican Chewbacca. Additionally, Alaska Republican Committee issued a public rebuke of McConnell's financial influence behind Murkowski. Not exactly what we're talking about here, is it? What he was talking about. Number five, McConnell defunded Arizona Senate candidate Blake Masters. In August, the Senate Leadership Fund suddenly canceled about $8 million worth of ad buys in Arizona. The cancellation hurt Republican candidate Blake Masters' chances of defeating Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat Arizona, who went on to defeat Masters by a narrow margin. Please play the second clip.
They're working hard, God bless them. It's at best just incompetent. But you know what else is incompetent, Tucker? The establishment, right? The people who control the purse strings. Senate Leadership Fund, Mitch McConnell. McConnell decided to spend millions of dollars attacking a fellow Republican in Alaska instead of helping me defeat Senator Mark Kelly. Had he chosen to spend money in Arizona, this race would be over. We'd be celebrating a Senate majority right now. And so my message to the people of America, my message to actually the Republican senators, hopefully my future colleagues, let's not vote Mitch McConnell into leadership. He doesn't deserve to be majority leader or minority leader. You get a choice. You can stand with your constituents and stand with Americans, or you can stand for Mitch McConnell. Tucker, if I'm lucky enough to represent Arizona in the U.S. Senate next year, I think it's clear where I'll stand.
Let me just ask you really quick.
That was Blake Masters probably upsetting Mitch McConnell and why he probably pulled that money away. But he spoke the truth. He was absolutely right.
Yep.
Number six, McConnell helped Joe Biden fuel inflation. Huh. I wrote about this in my paper. McConnell claimed in September that inflation was one of the top three greatest midterm issues, yet he and the Washington, D.C. establishment worked against conservatives to pass several massive spending bills that fueled soaring costs for American workers. From 2021 to 2022, McConnell voted for the $1.7 trillion omnibus spending, $1.9 trillion for COVID-19 corporate bailout, and the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bills, all items of legislation that had fueled inflation, according to experts. Experts projected soaring inflation would cost American families an extra $5,520 in 2022. A Heritage Foundation study showed Americans have lost $4,200 in annual income since Biden assumed office. Number seven, McConnell remained silent on Biden's speech attacking MAGA movement. Remember that? The big red fiery speech? In September, McConnell refused to condemn Biden's speech in Philadelphia that labeled MAGA Republicans a threat to the nation. MAGA Republicans do not respect the Constitution, Biden claimed. They do not believe in the rule of law. They do not recognize the will of the people. They promote authoritarian leaders, and they fan the flames of political violence that are a threat to our personal rights, to the pursuit of justice, to the rule of law, to the very soul of this country, he added. 5 days after the speech, McConnell's office refused to respond to Breitbart News' request for comment, and Biden was just in Kentucky with McConnell, sort of taking a victory lap on the Senate losing the Republican majority. I think this is where clip three comes in.
Into a six-year term.
On that topic, Leader McConnell, former President Trump this weekend took a lot of credit for your re-election in your speech at CPAC. I was wondering if you could respond to his comments there, and also how you think his endorsement might impact 2022, especially if he endorses against one of your senators like Lisa Murkowski.
Yeah, well, I want to thank him for the 15-point margin I had in 2014 as well. Someone else.
Yeah.
Jeez.
Right. So that's how grateful he was for the endorsement that Trump gave him, which he should have never done. But that's a different story. Number eight, McConnell voted yes on Senate gun control. In June, McConnell worked against conservatives and voted for gun control measures following the Uvalde, Texas shooting. The American people want their constitutional rights protected and their kids to be safe in school. They want both of those things at once, McConnell claimed. And that is just what the bill before the Senate will help accomplish. I wonder how the hunters of Kentucky feel about that. Number nine, and finally, McConnell voted to extend taxpayer aid to Ukraine. In March and September, McConnell opposed conservatives and voted for massive amounts of Ukraine aid. American taxpayers shelled out $14 billion in March. That sum was added to in September by $12.35 billion. In total, McConnell and Democrats have voted to give over $111 billion of taxpayer money to Ukraine.
Ugh.
Steve, what do you think of the former speaker, now minority leader of the Senate?
What state is he from? I should know this. He's been there.
Kentucky.
Kentucky. I guess Kentucky is not really conservative, not very constitutional oriented, because they keep voting this fossil into office. And I guess...
Well, the number two senator, the junior senator, is Rand Paul.
Yeah, so you got two factions within that state, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what the number one product that comes out of Kentucky is?
Whiskey.
Sunblock.
Oh, my gosh. No kidding.
So I'm sure there's a lot of chemical and export lobbying going on to make sure that he maintains his Chamber of Commerce
status
as the number one guy.
That's right. Money, money, money.
We'll be stuck with him for a little while longer since he just got reelected and is not the leader, but he was voted the Republican minority leader. So here's to you, Mitch. Stay tuned for my thought of the week.
Recording in progress.
Welcome to my inspirational thought to end the week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to the Mill Creek View podcast. Just go to Rumble or Spotify and hit the subscribe button and follow us. And thanks for doing it. I am a big believer in the mirror test. All that matters is if you look in the mirror and honestly tell the person you see there that you've done your best. John McKay, coached USC football from 1960 to 1975, also said, "We didn't tackle well today, but we made up for it by not blocking." He also said, "I told my team it didn't matter. There are 750 million people in China who don't even know this game was played." He led Southern California to four national championships. He said, "Everyone is unhappy at times, even my wife, only she doesn't get interviewed about it." John McKay was known for not only his extremely passionate personality and emotional outbursts, but also for his sense of humor and genuine warmth. Throughout his career, McKay faced extreme ups and downs and produced some really memorable football quotes. Safe to say, most people recognize the John McKay quote about execution. One of John McKay's most famous quotes includes his response to the question, "What did you think of your team's execution, coach?" He replied with it, "I'm in favor of it." Southern Cal went 127, 40, and 8, won nine Pac-8 championships. Southern Cal won national titles in 67, 72, and 94. The Trojans also won five Rose Bowls and finished first or second in the Pac-12 13 times. Thank you, John McKay, for an interesting, wonderful childhood for me. Well, that's it for this episode. Really hoped you liked it. Thank you, Ryan Abraham. Better luck next year. Fight on. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper. Peace in our time.
County Fair. They were looking for America behind every turn, flying the very colors that so
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.